this does feel like the rare case of a Twitter thread that is about something that is very serious and does have things that are really dark and sad about it, but is also just a fun ride.
Right. Well, how about like an RFK Jr. documentary or like a TV series, a limited series about all of his very weird adventures?
Who's going to play the brain worm?
Adventures.
I think David Schwimmer. David Schwimmer is the brain worm.
David Schwimmer is 100% the brain
Absolutely.
Worm.
Absolutely. I'm Max Fisher.
I'm Erin Ryan.
And joining us, Josie Duffy Rice from What a Day and so many other things. Josie, so happy to have you on.
I am thrilled to be here. What a dream.
It is a dream. This is the Offline Movie Club. Every week, we discuss one of our favorite movies and how it reflects or shapes how we think about technology and the internet. This week, we are talking about one of my favorites. I am so excited to talk about this movie, Zola, the 2021 film for anyone who has ever asked, why are you on my Twitter? Why are you on my Tumblr?
So good.
It's the first ever movie adapted from tweets, and honestly, probably the last, now that Elon Musk is running that service into the ground, which is maybe a curse, maybe a blessing.
I mean, the next birth of a nation, whatever that is, yeah, will be based on things that are currently happening on X.
It's true, yes.
Yeah. Surely with something Cat Turd
too in
X.
the title role. Yes.
Just starring Cat Turd.
Well, I am excited for an hour of pointing the podcast and saying, whose is this? Josie, let's start with you. What do you think makes this movie important for how we think about technology and the internet?
Well, I was trying to think if there's ever been a more viral, like crazy viral thread than the Zola thread. Mm-hmm. Do y'all remember the Zola thread? Like when it first?
I have to be honest, I missed it when it happened.
It consumed.
You missed it?
It was my life for like 3 days. It was a lot of people's
Agreed.
Lives.
Yeah, yeah.
It felt like something so new and crazy. Mm-hmm. It was like so unprecedented. It was so fun. That was when Twitter was like kind of fun. Mm-hmm. And it was also like an era of when I feel like we didn't know as much as we do about everybody all of the time. So it still felt kind of like a new crazy story.
I think that's a great point. That is something that is very novel about that particular moment, 2015. I remember so many viral moments. And then like, do you all remember Walter Palmer, the dentist who shot Cecil the Lion?
Oh, yes.
This was the era when it was like a Reddit
funny,
thread
about
it's funny how big of a thing it became. Like a dentist shot a lion and it was like the same thing. It consumed everybody's life for a few days and we're like looking up this guy's dental practice on Google Maps. And it seems like the Zola thread was part of it. People were like looking up Jessica, her Facebook and her mom's Facebook.
So, yes, right.
It was one of those first big moments of like online is the monoculture and it's also real life.
Mm-hmm.
It was also this thing where like it was so off the cuff. Like I feel like now when people tell stories, long threaded stories, it's very, doesn't feel very
authentic.
It always feels very planned. Yeah, it feels very, mm-hmm. yeah, it doesn't feel very authentic. It feels sort of like branding all of the time. And this right. was just some girl who was like, y'all want to hear a crazy story? Like, literally. And then captured the internet for, mm-hmm. you know, for days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it also, like, it's kind of reminding, what you were saying, Josie, reminds me of why I don't like the moth story hour. Because nobody starts a story with, like, I never thought about life the same way after mm-hmm. that day. Like, that's not how people
mm-hmm.
talk to each other.
Yeah.
So this, like you said, Josie, is how this, it's, it felt like she was sitting there talking mm-hmm. to you mm-hmm. or writing you
right.
something or getting a bunch of texts or something like that.
It was from right. what felt like a really pivotal moment where it's like the internet had become totally ubiquitous, but it had not yet become so like monetized and polished that everything felt like it was like a fake persona that somebody was trying to sell us mm-hmm. for cash.
Right. And we just didn't really, I mean, I guess we sort of knew how bad the internet could be, how it could ruin someone's life. But it was not yet at a point where it's like, oh, I'm going to tweet this and, you know, it'll follow me forever. It still mm-hmm. sort of felt like you could slip through the cracks, which I feel like now is that ship has sailed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think I, at this point, appreciated the power of the... Like, this was kind of the start of Gamergate, too. Like, it was the moment when it was, like, starting to become, like, a force in our politics and, like, the crazy shit that would happen on the internet. But it was not until, like, a year or two later when Trump got elected I started to take it more seriously.
But what's the, like, the official Russian pronunciation of Gamergate? Because we should use, like, the intended...
Gamergatia.
Yeah, probably. You know, the thing that I realized when I was watching this is that, first of all, it's a movie about the world's oldest profession,
mm-hmm, right?
Using mm-hmm. the world's newest technology,
right?
And it's kind of a funny juxtaposition, but it's also it also reminded me of how authenticity cannot be faked. Like, you can't, mm-hmm. And it's such a commodity when you encounter something that is authentically wild. This mm-hmm. voice was an authentic person's voice. She didn't seem like she was putting anything on. It's like, oh, this is just how this person talks and communicates. And despite the fact that at the time the slang that she was using was not widely used, mm-hmm. it felt like you got a sort of, you got to peek in and be like, ooh, I'm a part of this now too. I get to LARP, like I'm involved in this story.
Right.
I get to LARP as this like really fun, confident stripper's friend. Mm-hmm. And it's a new way that storytelling can make the people taking in the story feel like they're participating in it.
Yeah, it does. Something about the way that she told the story really does pull you into that world. And you really do feel like you're right. And the fact that you're reading it in real time mm-hmm. as she is posting these tweets over like 6 or 7 hours makes you feel like you're kind of living the story with her. Mm-hmm. I have to be honest. When I first heard about this movie, was really turned off by the premise. I was like, it's adapted from tweets. Like, what a dumb gimmick. Like, that's so lame. And I didn't watch it until last year because I kept hearing from friends who worked in film or were like big movie nerds who were like, no, you need to watch this movie. It's really good. The woman who directed Jenixa Bravo is like, she's really got a lot to say. It's much more clever and interesting than you think it is. And I really think that even though this is not a movie that is about being online, like it's about sex work and sex trafficking, but I do think it is one of the best portrayals I have seen in a movie of living on social media and living on the internet. Like Zola, Stephanie, and Derek, they're all extremely online. They all have like multiple crisscrossing personas and these different apps that they're on and these like stories that they're all telling simultaneously on these platforms all collide with the real world in a way that like really resonates. And it's also like the movie itself is a product of the online stories and real world stories colliding because it's like Zola told this Twitter thread, but it's half adapted from the Twitter thread. And it's half adapted from a magazine piece that was like re-reporting it. And there's differences in the stories. And it's like so much in the movie, we are watching these characters construct personas, which is what you do online. And it's what Zola did when she posted that viral thread that became the movie. And it's about like performing a narrative. It's about performing an identity. Jenixa Bravo has talked about how it is also about having a voice and storytelling for people who would not have agency over their own story anyway, which is like very online. I love one of the first scenes in the movie we have a clip from. The first real conversation between Zola and Stephanie when they are bonding is about people being fake online.
Like, why are you on my Twitter? Why are you on my Facebook? Why are you on my Tumblr?
Why are you DMing me? Sis, why are you tagging me in photos? You don't even fuck with me.
Sis.
Let me know.
Sis.
Let me know.
Yes,
me-
sis.
Every 3 minutes, the movie is reminding you, like, by the way, this is about the phones. This mm-hmm. is about the internet. Even if that's not, like, what the story is kind of frontally about.
Yeah, the little Twitter sound effect that is constantly punctuating the film.
I thought that was a great... I was so glad that we didn't have her constantly turning to the camera and be like, and then I said this on my Twitter thread later. Like, it was just enough to kind of pull us in.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting, though? It's also, like, a very... There's something almost timeless about what happens in this movie and that it is so centered around social media, but you can see how you would make this movie 10 years ago or 20 years ago or... I mean, like mm-hmm. you said, it's the world, like you said, Aaron, it's the world's oldest profession. And so it's both this like very interesting kind of like portrayal of how ubiquitous this social element is. And there's something about it that feels like it could be at any point. Like, I'm like, mm-hmm. this would be a really interesting movie they made in the 70s, right? Like, obviously, you're going to need pay phones, mm-hmm. right? You're going to need a whole different kind of way of communicating. But you are like the fundamental parts of like, I met someone random, went on a trip with them. And came to quickly regret it are, you know, like work in all of these different contexts.
Yeah. And yeah. Florida is the place where notoriously, seriously, girl friendships die in Florida. And I think Josie probably knows that.
Absolutely correct.
It is. Yes. If you go on a trip to Miami with your girlfriends,
it's over.
Somebody is going to not be friends by the time you leave.
And is Tampa worse than that?
Yes.
Would you say?
I was there in 2012 for the Republican convention. It is. It's not a good place.
It is. Well, we get that scene where they're driving down to Tampa and you really feel like you are transferring into another world and like another reality. And Florida does have that feel. All right. Well, let's get into it. Erin, what do you think is the biggest thing this movie gets right?
This isn't necessarily about social media, but it does apply to social media because it sped up this process. But I think the movie does a really good job of showing us where culture is made in America and like where slang comes from. This thread is from 2015, and I was reading it again before we recorded just to prep. And she tweets like how teenagers talk now. And like the way that slang moves through American culture is like a lot of times marginalized people say it first, especially Black women, and then it gets adapted by gay men, and then it moves like that. Yeah. And so I think that the film feels really timely, even though it's based on original source material from like, how many years? 9 years ago? But it feels
it is amazing how current it still feels.
It feels very fresh. Yeah. And I think that that's like the biggest thing it gets right. And social media has expedited that. Like we now, you know, it used to be in the 90s, I don't know, Paris is Burning came out. Mm-hmm. And then several years later, slang that was being used by these LGBTQ people became more mainstreamed. And this time, in this day and age, things just happen more quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, you have somebody sending a tweet storm in 2015, and by, you know, a few years later, everyone is talking.
It's totally absorbed in the bloodstream.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Josie, what do you think? What's the biggest thing the movie gets right?
The biggest thing the movie gets right is Florida. It just gets Florida so
dead on. Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, what Erin said is totally right. It's like, there's also this thing of like being in your 20s. I'm assuming they're like in their 20s when you're making.
I think they're like 18 and 19 in the story.
Okay,
but
even better.
It's like you're making the long 20s.
Dumbest decisions. but it's like interesting because Zola still has kind of the sense to be like I don't need to be here, but I've obviously. Like, I've done so many dumb things, but I do have a limit. It's, like, so just fascinating. It just reminded me, it truly reminded me. I was, like, you know, because I grew up in Georgia. I'm, like, how many times did I almost die in Florida? So many times. I doing?
Look, I've had good experiences in Florida, and I've had bad experiences in Florida. But the vibes of Florida are not good vibes. Mm-hmm. It is sinister. Mm-hmm. Everything is, like, humid all the time. It's
so chaotic.
So chaotic. Yeah. And some in some ways, like, really aggressively unsexy. Mm-hmm. Because even the scenes in, like, the strip club where, like, both of the actresses are absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. But they figured out a way to film the stripping scenes in a way that we're just kind of, like, it's not a titillating stripper scene.
Right.
It's not sad. It's not like,
it just feels a little grody.
Yeah. You feel like you're a person in the strip club and you have this like beautiful person on stage in this dingy environment. And so the whole experience feels like not sexy.
I thought they conveyed that so well in just that one line where they have when she, Taylor Page is first stripping and they reverse shot to the guy who's giving her a tip and he says, "You look just like Whoopi Goldberg." And immediately you're like, I know what this place is. And like, you notice the room is empty and you're like, I understand what's going on here. And the look on her face, she's like, she understands what she's getting into. And it really does an incredible job of setting the scene. I saw this for the first time right around the same time I saw Harmony Korine's Spring Breakers. Have you all seen that? Another Florida classic.
Spring Breakers.
James Franco, who was in that, was originally going to direct this. Mm-hmm. Did you guys, which is, thank God, incredible bullet dodged
so
on
that
one.
I'm so glad that
didn't happen. By Zola herself. Because Zola was like, I don't think I want all these white boys telling my story.
Right.
And then she,
she did a really, really good job selling this story and managing it, where she has talked about that she was under a lot of pressure after the tweet thread when she first sold the rights to it or was selling the rights to it, that, like, you have to make the movie right away because it's going to age and you have to capture the audience for it. And she's talked about, like, she had a little money saved up and she was like, no, like, they're trying to dangle this check in front of me to get me to, like, take the easy money right away. And she held out. She got 2.5% of the profit and she got an EP credit. And it was made by a great screenwriter, playwright, and director. So she definitely made some good choices.
Mm-hmm.
She did a really excellent job.
I hate the boss. Like, I hate that phraseology, but she's really very much in control and smart and savvy.
Very self-possessed, which comes through in her character in the movie, I feel.
Of course, yeah.
And she's talked about how she was, like, she's of this world, but a little bit outside of it. Like, she talks about, like, her mom is a paralegal. So she was, like, she had a choice. Like, she didn't get into sex work, which is the phrase she uses for it, because she felt compelled to. She got into it because she loved it. And I think you feel that a little bit, where she's like, she's there because she cares about it, but also is, like, a little bit removed from it. I just thought that the movie did an incredible job of portraying, but without making a big deal about it, about the way that social media lives and real lives intersect. And that we're, like, they're constantly on their phones. They're constantly, like, something will happen in the room and one of them will post about it to Facebook, and then the next scene their post will come back and have consequences in the room. And, like, the way that those things reverberate back and forth is, like, certainly when you were in your 20s in the 2010s sounds very familiar. But there's, like, there's catfishing in the movie, there's doxing, there's, like, embellishment, there's people who, like, have these different personalities. It's just, like, I just thought it was an amazing, I had to watch it the second time to pick up on this portrayal of being online in the real world.
I think that it also, like, on a meta level, kind of captures the, like, humor and darkness of just being on the internet. Because there's a clip I wanted to play. It comes from the very last scene. So if you haven't seen the movie, I mean, it's not really spoiling anything. The final scene, they're all at X's house, which is funny because Twitter is now X.
That kept occurring to me too.
Yeah.
It makes it that he is the personification of Twitter.
Yes.
It definitely feels like it tracks a little bit now.
Exactly. Although he was Z in the Twitter thread, but regardless. So this is the final scene, and this is a moment where something really tragic is happening and everyone is just laughing at it.
Yo, I'm serious. I'm gonna kill myself. Yo, I'm gonna kill myself.
Why you gotta be so dramatic?
Swear to God, Bible, this nigga fucking jumps.
Okay, she did later say that he did not jump.
Yes.
That was one of the embellished. But yeah, the way that they're, like, laughing at it as it's serious.
Right, but, like, that's how we exist online. Like, serious things are happening and people are like, ha ha.
That's a great point.
This is like, oh, isn't it funny that this happened? And it's like... Right.
Laughing at Trump tweets, even as you're horrified by them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and
that's a great point.
Even in the film, like, the film is full of those moments where you're just like... There's another clip with our buddy Derek. This is another example of, like, the experience of being online, I think. And this is from after Stephanie is abducted by a rival pimp and they are going back to retrieve her.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this one.
Guess who opens the door? The nigga Derek was doing magic with at that nasty ass motel.
Yo, I thought we were homies.
We not.
Okay, this is a super serious situation. There are guns.
Mm-hmm.
There is human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
There is, like, people could die. And then you have Derek saying, I thought we were homies. And, like, it's funny, but it's...
Cousin Greg as the comic relief. Is a
incredible.
Nice touch.
Yeah.
And Coleman Domingo, he is amazing in this movie.
And so good.
I had like seen him in a lot of things before. Like, he's in Lincoln, like, he popped up in a lot. I know he did a lot in theater, but I haven't seen Rustin yet. But this is the first thing I saw where he's like really has a meaty role. And it's like, oh, of course he won the Oscar a year later. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
He and Riley Keough, the way that they play these like larger than life personas, where you're like, are these people real? Are they, like, performing a character? Is this really who they are? Do they even know the difference? I just think it's so perfect. And it's, like, the way that Taylor Page has to play against them is so great. I just, really great performance at the heart of it. To like the meta onlineness of it, there's another scene that I really love. The Room of Mirrors, which is the very first shot we see at the start of the movie, where Zola and Stephanie are in this, like, they're surrounded by mirrors, they're putting on makeup. Zola is speaking to the camera where she's like narrating her tweets. It's got this feeling of unreality. And we don't know, at that moment, it looks like a happy scene. And we only learn like 3/4 into the movie. It's like, oh, this is, I think it's right before they go to that hotel at the very end. Like, it's actually a really scary scene because Zola has been like forcibly enlisted into this. They're both facing this threat of violence. And the, like, the metaphor of being in this room of mirrors and like, who are they? Like, they don't know who each other is. They don't know who they are themselves. And this sense of like, not knowing how to navigate and that being like really scary and this mysteriousness of it. I also thought really works well for the Stephanie character, the Riley Keough character, where she's like, is she a villain? Is she a victim? Is she both? Does she know? That just like everyone is so far falling down this rabbit hole of playing these different personalities for each other. They've kind of lost a sense of what's real and not real.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting because it's one thing I like about this movie is that it could be really sad and it's not. If you recount this movie, if you describe it to someone, it sounds like a tragic right. movie. It just doesn't sound like it has any lightness in it. And there is something kind of amazing about how it doesn't, that's not the tone of the movie. And you don't, I didn't feel like bad for these women the whole time or anything like that. It didn't feel... Not, I don't think it would be infantilizing to feel bad for them given the circumstances, but you know they're going to be okay. There is some sense of like, you're going to get out of this current situation all right in a way that I think is extremely well done because it's so easy to be heavy-handed about some of this stuff in a way that ends up feeling moralizing. And here it's fun. It's a fun movie, even though you're like, what the fuck?
Well, Zola, when she first told the story, it was on Tumblr, which, as she had said, was kind of her like original social media platform. She was a big Tumblr girly. When she first told that story, it was very serious and sad. And she said that she wrote it right after she got back and she was processing what she'd been through, this horrific incident. And it was only 6 months later that she decided to tell it again on Twitter as kind of a farce and an adventure because it was a way to take possession of the story and have agency over it by telling it in a way where she was like laughing at it. Instead of being victimized by it, which is also what the movie is doing. It's about giving and taking voice on social media.
And voice is like power because she is so powerless throughout the story, except for the fact that she's a storyteller. She gets to break the fourth wall and she doesn't cry until the very end. Like she doesn't like lose control. So like I feel as though the movie does a good job of being like, this is a person who is powerless in this really fucked up situation who was able to take power back by telling the story, by surviving and telling the story. And there's actually, we have a clip of her talking about it on a podcast.
Like, I told it on Tumblr the day, like, as soon as I got home.
Right, like, dear diary.
Like, So, like, I sat my family down, and I was like, you guys, this is what happened to me. My mom, she's so dramatic. She's, like, crying.
Did you live with her at the time?
Yes.
Yeah.
She's like, why didn't you tell me? I'm like, girl, I was coming home. It's okay.
Yeah.
So then, after I started, like, processing it, and I saw how she was just, like, devastated, I'm like, maybe it was a big deal. So then I went on Tumblr, and kind of, like, Tumblr's my diary.
Yeah.
So I was just like, you guys will never guess why. Happen and I just briefly told it. I didn't like get in depth.
You didn't say you want to hear a story about how me and this bitch fell out. It wasn't there yet.
Nothing was funny.
Right.
I was still processing.
You were still like, holy shit.
Yeah. It wasn't funny at all. I was like, I think I was kidnapped, but I'm not sure.
Right.
Erin, did you clock whose podcast that is?
Who?
Julia Fox.
Yeah.
I was listening to the same thing for research. I was like, oh, this is kind of a fun interview. I was like, why does this woman's voice sound familiar? And then I realized it's Julia Fox.
Right. I was like, why do I really, like, this person and I seem to not have that much in common, but I really like her? It's Julia Fox.
I was just going to say, it's so funny how she's like, I came home and told the story to my mom. My mom's so dramatic. She started crying. It's like, I don't know if your mom's
it's a
dramatic.
Sad story.
I think feels like it would be really stressful to hear that.
like Josie, we're work friends. If you told me that story had happened to you, I would probably start crying.
Yeah, I would be upset.
Exactly.
As well.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's just such a 19-year-old's reaction to be like, she totally overreacted to be maybe getting kidnapped.
But also, I think like being in the world of sex work, you have to probably develop a, like an emotional removal from like what's happening to you
right.
or what's happening around you, or you have to decide that you just don't care in mm-hmm. the way that you would care if you were not getting paid to do it.
Right.
So, like, mm-hmm. I think that, that's an unintentionally, like, telling moment.
Well, we should talk about the portrayal of sex work and sex trafficking. And there's we have another clip of the director, Jenixa Bravo, talking about how she wanted to make the movie feel really claustrophobic. And I didn't even notice this until I heard her in an interview, that it's a lot of really tight, close shots throughout the movie that is supposed to put you in the experience of these two women, where they're trapped in rooms, they're trapped in cars, they kind of don't have control over the situation. It does make you feel very tense because you can't kind of see around corners. You don't know what's happening around them. So let's play that clip of Jenixa Bravo talking.
At least the first third of the movie, or a portion of the movie, you really feel like Zola is in charge of her own story. And at a certain point, X takes it out of her hands. And so she has this like room to go have this moment at the pool. And then he literally enters and blocks her sunlight and reminds her of who is in control of her voice. What I'd hoped here is that the scene would remind us that some of our relationship to sex work, sex slavery, is something that we have the privilege of getting to experience at an arm's length distance. And here it tells us that it's actually right next to us, and it's whether or not we choose to see it.
Josie, what did you think about the movie's portrayal of sex trafficking?
You know, I really appreciate when any kind of portrayal of something like this tells the story without taking agency completely away from the people going through it. And that's what's really like interesting here. It's like everybody is kind of, at least until the point where, let's say to the point where they're in the room and she's like, you're not charging enough, mm-hmm. right? Up until that point, everybody is kind of making their own decisions. You get the impression that they don't necessarily have to be there. That gets complicated later on. But I would say even Riley's character, like you get this sense that they are choosing this and that it's grimy and not fun and terrible and a kind of a way to get by. And it is, I think, also a good example of like how most of the time this stuff happens and it's just a story you tell one day. It doesn't right. always end in, you know, a life-altering thing, right?
Right.
To do sex work or, you know, it doesn't always totally, you know, you don't always end up in prison. You're not always arrested. You're not always people make decisions that, you know, affect them emotionally for the rest of their lives, maybe, or like mm-hmm. have some impact on their psyche, but don't necessarily divert their life off the, you know, off the path in a way that I think every kind of portrayal of sex work is always sort of like a huge warning sign. And I think we all get away from this being like, we don't want, this is not the life we want to live. But not in a way that feels like someone's wagging their finger at you.
It's a great point. We don't have, and I'm so glad we don't have it, we don't have the scene at the end where Zola turns to the camera and is like, and because of this, I'd learned to join the church and go straight. And we don't have the scene of like, although maybe we should have like seen what happened to Z and Stephanie after the fact, mm-hmm. and like what happened to them. But yes, it is just, it's an experience they all have and then the experience ends.
Mm-hmm. You know, let's talk about the scene that you mentioned, Josie, the scene where they're in the hotel room. One thing I got from that scene is that that Stephanie super undervalues herself when men are telling her how much she's worth.
Right.
And when it's a woman, they're able to like feel, it feels more, it's like the safest feeling scene in the movie, weirdly, even though there's this parade of like men coming in to have sex.
Zola's asserting agency over this situation.
Exactly. But it's women are in charge of their own, it is women in charge of their own sexuality. Zola makes the ad for her. Mm-hmm. Stephanie willingly participates. Like she's totally down with like, so let's play that scene because I think it has one of the funniest lines in the whole movie in it too.
Pardon? That guy just gave you $150.
Yeah.
20 minutes on the pole is damn near $150.
On a good night.
Pussy is worth thousands, bitch.
I don't set the price.
$500 a pop.
That's too much.
It's not.
I love the, I knew this aside, that whenever they have the Glockenspiel in the score as mm-hmm. the ping notifications are going off, it's such a great way to blur the line between what's happening on the phones and in real life and what's happening in the score. I just thought it was brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Well, pussy is worth thousands. Funny.
Pussy's worth thousands. And it's so funny how, like, when he's like, you think you can do my job better than me? It's like, yeah.
She just did.
This is your only job. And you're not even profit maximizing. What is the problem here?
So it's
just very amazing, that moment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's the scene that you're referencing, Josie, that to me is like the pivotal scene of the movie, where it's the morning after, mm-hmm. when they're in hotel, where it's like the next morning, Coleman Domingo's characters come in. And it's where we flip from kind of playing the story for laughs to it becoming much more serious. And it's so much of it is the Riley Keough and Coleman Domingo performances, where Stephanie gives X, Z, whatever, the money and tells him, that's all from me. And you can see the way that she is so quiet and she's searching his face for approval. You kind of, for the first time, realize where she is, mm-hmm. that she is like, that approval is so inaccessible and important to her, but there's also fear on her face and there's this longing. You realize the like kind of emotional control that he has over her, mm-hmm. which is of course part of sex trafficking. And then you also see Taylor Page like playing the audience surrogate, where she's like really scornful of this because she understands what's happening because she's been in this world, but she's also really nervous because she knows, like, is the Coleman Domingo character going to be pleased with all the money? Is he going to find some excuse to get angry where they're going to be in physical danger? I just thought it was a brilliant scene. And mm-hmm. I thought putting it at the exact, like, 2 second midpoint of the movie was really smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
I want to talk a little bit about the filmmaking just because I was so impressed by it. Something I noticed this time around, the lighting and the images at the start of the movie are like really gauzy and grainy and have this ethereal lighting. It's this feeling of unreality, like everything feels like really cotton candy. And as we progress through the movie, the lighting gets much colder and sharper, and you start to feel this like transition from the like gauzy online world to the hard reality. And there's this thing that she does where she's constantly putting you back in the experience of being on the phone. Like there's the scene where they're at the would-be gangbang, where Zola's trying to call Coleman Domingo's character and the volume notification is on the screen. Mm-hmm. Every time they show the date or the time, it's the iPhone lock screen, which I thought was really clever. And that scene with the Hannah Montana scene, which is just like, it's an amazing scene.
So funny.
It's so fun.
Good.
But it's shot perfect. On an iPhone.
Oh.
And you really feel like I'm inside the phone. And
yeah.
I think it's like, it's so smart how she's constantly reminding you that like, we're going to pull you back into the phone.
You mentioned Spring Breakers. And mm-hmm. I actually think that the Britney Spears song that they dance to while holding guns.
Yes.
I think that the Hannah Montana scene is better than that musical scene. I know.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just like...
It's not as iconic because that scene is so like, you've got
silly.
The piano. Right. It's so silly and so over the top. But yeah, they're both... I mean, if you have a road trip to Florida, you've got to have a singing along to a pop song scene.
Every time. And Hannah Montana... And I'm sure there's going to be another one.
Yep. Something else on the portrayal of sex trafficking I thought was really smart is the scene just before the kidnapping scene in the hotel. They drive by those two cops who are beating and tasing someone who's crying out for help. And I thought that was so smart because that way the audience is not getting to that scene and saying, like, why don't they just call the cops? Like, why don't they just call the police? It's like, well, you know why, because you've just seen the scene, so you understand that they know that they're not safe.
Mm-hmm. There's a really interesting... element of this movie too, which is like there's not a single male hero or even redeemable personality. Not everybody's bad in the same way, but you could see how this movie could easily become kind of a one-dimensional look at these sex workers, and instead even given all of the many issues that both these women have, the world of men that are around is just so, like, at best below average.
Right.
Well, they're like menacing or pathetic.
Right.
Like, there's there's no in between. Yeah.
Right.
Like even Zola's boyfriend, who she said she had to fuck him quiet or something like that. That's sort of like played as a little bit pathetic. And Zola's boyfriend is definitely
right.
Pathetic.
He's very passive. Yeah. Josie, that reminds me of one of my favorite scenes in the movie, in the strip club, the prayer scene where it's all the women are gathered around. You guys remember this scene?
Yeah.
It's like one of the only moments where you feel like safe and people are looking out for each other. That monologue, that prayer, was completely improvised. Did you guys know this?
That's so funny.
It's a great story. It's so the woman who is giving that prayer is a trans activist named T.S. Madison, who had been really big on Vine. And Janiska Bravo had been a fan of hers forever, cast her off of her Vine account in a Vice web series that ended up not happening, kept her in mind. And T.S. Madison, that woman, has talked about how The Crying Game, the 1992 movie, helped her connect with her identity, which is beautiful and a reminder that movies matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although The Crying Game is problematic.
No doubt. But it was meaningful
today,
for her.
Oh, yes. For sure. Because it was a depiction that didn't exist prior.
Right.
And we've gotten better at it since.
Although there's an interesting conversation about like the ways that it was ahead of its time in some ways. But like, but anyway, that's a separate Crying Game podcast.
Okay.
What is the biggest thing this movie gets wrong? There's a lot of fact-checky stuff, but do you guys have anything before we get into the like reality versus Twitter of it all?
Look, I've never been a sex worker, but I have never had a night that lasted all night long without there being drugs and or alcohol involved.
That's a great point.
So the lack of any consumption of anything, I was kind of like, come on. Like, somebody is doing something, and it would be kind of out in the open. And it's just not, it's not there. And that's, you know, what's fine. It's a choice.
Sure.
But it did for, you know, I was kind of like, what?
That's funny. I wonder why that is. I wonder if it's just because, like, Zola left it out of her Twitter thread for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it did happen. And
how
then
are they staying up this long?
Right.
Like, they're right. In Florida. How are they staying up this? And they're not in cocaine Florida. They're in meth Florida. I'm not criticizing the film at all.
It's noticeable.
It was
yeah.
a choice.
No,
I noticed it.
I got you.
It is funny, too. That's a really great point also because of the disassociating necessary to, like, get through that scene where with all the men in the room, like, you're like, you need drugs.
Yeah.
This is not the time to be sober.
Yes.
For sure. I think that there is an element of surprise by the expectation that, you know, they're going to have to basically not just strip, but get with these dudes, sleep with these dudes, that rang to me a little naive for this character. Like, I was like, this sort of seems like this is where this was going.
Right.
And
you think the real Zola knew somewhere deep down that when she was going
to
Tampa,
just like,
what was in the cards.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I'm like, you know, like, from the moment that she's in the car and she's sort of looking at them like, what's y'all's deal?
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's so skeptical from the beginning. And when you were kind of like on that close to, you know, that's not that crazy, right, of like a conclusion to draw by this random, like, three people driving down to Florida. Nobody really seemed, you can't tell what everybody's relationship is. So the surprise, I think I was like, we know where this is going, right?
Especially the quote unquote roommate who drives the G-Wagon.
Right.
That's
exactly.
That's a flag of some particular color. So Zola has said that she embellished the suicide attempt, didn't happen. The whole shooting scene and the like kidnapping in the hotel, she said that she's embellished. And she has said that she was kind of riffing in response to how people were reacting to her tweets in real time, where she saw things that they liked and kind of played down things based on what she thought was going to kind of play to the audience she was getting. One thing that got left out of the movie, which is otherwise like very true to the Twitter thread, which I thought was an interesting choice because the reported version of it in Rolling Stone, which Zola has said is true, the movie is like, does not use that as much, even though that was out at that time. But I guess they just thought that the Twitter thread is real in the sense that that was the story that went viral. Something that did not get included is that Riley Keough's character and Coleman Domingo's character, I guess, had sex in front of Zola and then showed the photos of that to Derek as like a power move, which is, I think maybe they thought that would just be like too dark and too fucked up that early in the movie. And it gives you a little bit too much information about the power dynamic. The Derek character did post on Stephanie's Facebook page and posted, hey, sucking old man dick for dollars, you're the true MVP, go Jessica, which is one of the most passive-aggressive Facebook comments I have ever read. And also included screenshots of the backstage ads, and her mother was, in Zola's words, going off in the comments. He did also, when he was stuck at the motel, this Derek guy, he was really, really Cousin Greg down to his core. He did befriend someone who he met at a gas station and went to his house and got stoned, which is a real choice when you're in Florida. And the kidnapping scene, there's like a few different versions. Zola later said that there was no violence, but the guy, Dion, who was the other like competing pimp who kidnapped her, didn't hurt her, but did offer $20,000 to Coleman Domingo's character. Derek said that Zola actually did not go along to that, that he just went with the Coleman Domingo character and that there was no violence, but that Z did have the front desk call the cops on their way out. So who knows what really happened in that room?
Mm-hmm. Does it really matter?
It doesn't really matter. No, but it just, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's, but no, I'm just saying, like, because the movie, that's what's in the movie. It's sort of like, yeah, there's a million different ways that this could have happened. But the right. most important thing is the story that this person told. Like,
right.
the facts aren't as important as her experience or her story.
I think that's right. And that the movie tells you that. Like, mm-hmm. I think that room full of mirrors scene is telling you that what we're actually talking about is their experience. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have to talk about my favorite scene in this movie, which is Stephanie's story.
Okay.
Where she, which I thought was so this is based off of a real Reddit post that she did in fact make that is so long, where she tells her version of the story. And the movie is pretty close. We'll play the clip. And then I actually want to read some quotes from the Reddit quotes, but it's amazing. And I thought it was so clever to present this as a fake documentary, because it's such a great way to convey the experience of reading someone posting on social media their version of events that you know is bullshit. From the start, you know it's not true, and it feels like a shitty documentary, and I thought it was a really smart way to convert it, like, to film. So let's play a clip of Riley Keough absolutely killing it in this scene.
I told her that my good friend, Abagunde Alawale, who was promoted in Tampa, had invited me and my boyfriend to Tampa to be his guest for the weekend. And she was like, let me dance at the club he promoted. And I was like, is that how that works? Because I don't know how that works.
That's so funny. Okay, some quotes from her extremely long Reddit post. Let's start by saying that the true beginning of Asia's story is about the only part of her story that is somewhat true. However, the thing that got in the car with myself and the man we will continue to call Z was not the same Asia I picked up in the bar days before. This girl walks in with some basic leggings and torn shirt and a short nappy wig that, excuse my language, smell like ass. Then later, talking about going to the club in Tampa, I was given paperwork immediately to sign and hired on the spot, and Asia, who hadn't cleaned herself up like I'd hoped, had to audition. Reason to be a jealous bitch number one. That's right, she really wrote that. Within an hour or two, I made only $100, not something I was pleased with, and Asia made $1. Reason to be a jealous bitch number two. I love that she really said she made $1. I think it's the funniest line in the movie.
$1? Okay, that is where I'm like, this didn't happen.
This story is not true.
This whole story did not happen.
I cannot say.
Also, it's so irrelevant to anything.
Right.
It's like, who cares? Like, none of this matters.
No. It's just social media fighting over reputation and persona.
Right.
So all in all, like my Twitter says, I give Asia a round of applause on her creativity. After years of a blog and trapping, this girl finally got some attention, which is just, isn't that the sign off from every firing back at an accuser Twitter thread you've ever read?
Okay, yes. But also, Asia, a.k.a. Zola, mm-hmm. was fairly popular on social media before.
Right.
She had like 10,000 followers on Twitter, and mm-hmm. she used her Twitter to like advertise herself as a sex worker. Mm-hmm. And she is really open about that. Mm-hmm. So to say that she finally got some attention is like really, no, she was getting plenty of attention.
Right. The fact that the story is, and they, again, I thought they captured this so well in the movie, the obvious fakeness of the story, where like when she shows up at Hooters and there are twigs in her hair and she gets in the car in a trash bag.
Yeah.
It's funny to think about the point about her using her Twitter to like advertise for sex work, because now that's actually so much more common. Mm-hmm. This is pre-OnlyFans. It's like kind of pre this like new era of like almost more accessible sex work, more normalized, you know, sex mm-hmm. work. And I think, like, I would say, like, less shameful. Like, we've kind of at least are chipping away at some of the shame element. And it's just, it's almost quaint, right? This idea of like Backpage, and it's like both a new era of sex work on the internet and also now kind of a dated one, right?
Yeah.
Like, are they going to Tampa anymore to dance? I don't know. Or like, what are they, you know, like, this is just a different world, right?
Mm-hmm. It does, in retrospect, feel like the start of something. And even the fact that she is posting this later as a Twitter thread. This was back when it was like, it was really hard to thread. You had to, like, reply to each individual tweet. Mm-hmm. And if you deleted one, it would fuck up the whole series. Mm-hmm. And she talked about how she is, like, one of the first people to post a lot of, like, long threads with long stories. Okay, so what happened after all of this? It's pretty dark. Like, a couple of weeks after this, X, Z, I don't know how to refer to him, and Stephanie got arrested in Reno for kidnapping and human trafficking. There were two women who knew Stephanie in real life, or like were messaging her on Facebook because they were driving through Reno on a road trip. Their car broke down. They messaged her for help. Stephanie and X flew out to Reno to meet them, which is a big warning sign or big red flag, and basically kidnapped them in this hotel and like locked them up and trafficked them. And there was a lot of violence. It was really dark. X is still in jail. One of the women who he trafficked in this said that he hired a hitman to come after her while she was, I guess, preparing to testify in his trial.
Okay. Wait a second. Hitmen, we can all acknowledge, are almost always entrapment situations, right?
I think that's the implication is that's what happened
like,
here, too.
People
I have a lot of questions, yep.
Yeah, I mean, if you're dumb enough to hire a hitman and not know...
From prison.
The person is trying to... They're trying to get you to stay in prison for longer. They are part of...
Right.
They're not... Hitmen. They are cops. Like, you are... Mm-hmm. But I'm not a... Josie,
anybody who's dumb enough to try to hire a hitman... No, it's so true. It's like, you... If you are dumb enough to try to hire a hitman, you are not going to be able to hire a hit... You're not going to be able to hire a hitman.
Right.
You just don't... It's a total mismatch there.
Yeah.
In terms of skill level.
You have to use, like, Putin-esque, like, tactics. You have to convince someone to... just think they're deciding to work for you.
You need a Chechen warlord.
And exactly. And then convince them to believe that it was their idea to kill the person that you want dead. That is very advanced.
This is very detailed advice.
I mean...
This is useful. I'm taking notes.
It's true.
I'm not a CIA asset in any way. I have no idea what those letters even stand for.
It's also funny because every hitman is so cheap, relatively. It's always like, I said I'd pay them $10,000. It's like, it's going to be more expensive than that.
Yes.
If you wanted someone to... Like, the people, someone's risking their whole future. You gotta up the cost.
Again, you both have so much more information on this than I ever would have. I'm a law-abiding citizen, so I don't know about any of this. All right, Josie,
if you ever
moment...
need someone killed, you know who to ask.
I actually don't know because it's one of you two. I don't know how to pick. Or maybe I have a like bidding situation to see who
together.
Gets me a better offer.
Together.
Okay, that's nice. Yeah,
we're
you're unionizing. Mm-hmm. I love that. Josie, moment you most related to personally from the movie?
Oh, okay. I'm telling you all, there's something about this that's way more extreme than my childhood, but I do remember like being in the car with people where I'm like, I could die in this car.
This is exactly what I was going to say. Right.
Yeah.
Like, why am I here? Like,
right.
This
yes.
is sort of just like, these are not really my people. But now I'm here, so I'm going to ride this out. Like, there is such an element of that that felt so, so real to me, and especially about that age, you know? And when they're driving off at the end and they're speeding across the bridge, and I'm just like, I can imagine being in the backseat, like, this could be it for me for no reason. I feel so stupid for this being it.
Oh, the scene where Stephanie's throwing the guns into the water,
yes.
like she's done that before, and like
right.
the cuts back to Zola are just—it's so funny.
Mm-hmm.
Her just being like, she's dissociating at
yes.
this point. She is just like, okay, but yeah, it's that feeling. She's like, why am I? What am I doing?
I had that. Mm-hmm. I had the exact same thing in my notes, Josie. That feeling when you're on a road trip and you're just far enough down the road that there's no way for you to get back. So you realize you were stuck in that fucking car. And that reverse shot of Taylor Page, the look on her face where she's like, who are these people? At best, they're very annoying. And at worst, I'm going to die. That's like, that's definitely a road trip with people who you kind of know at age 19.
Oh, my God. Well, there's also like a point in the night when the night is not going to get any more fun. And if you continue the night, it is going to get bleaker and bleaker as time goes on. You don't need to order another drink. You don't need to do whatever it is you do. You don't need to do any more of whatever it is you're doing. It is time to pack it up and leave the party. And like, this is a movie that answers the question, what if nobody ever left the party? What if the party just continued down a spiral toward hell? Where does it end? And it ends at Z's house.
Right.
Or X's house.
Right. And they put a button on this perfectly where when they're in that like downward spiral into hell, like second to last step, what happens? Zola gets a call from her mom.
Yep.
Because that's what always, when you're in the worst, most serious moment of your life, what happens? Unprompted call from mom.
Yeah.
And you have to be so, play it so cool.
Yeah. I also related to the having a friend that is trouble. Like a friend that you just like, I think this might, I don't know if this is a girl friendship thing, but you meet a girl that you just click with and you're like, yes, bitch, we are friends. We're going to hang out. You don't know that much about her, but you have like such a good rapport that you're like, okay, cool. Like, I'll go to this party with you. I'll do this thing with you. And then it gets to a point where you're like, we cannot be friends. Like, you are straight up buying heroin right now. Like, we cannot be friends. Like, we can't hang out. You are dangerous. I'm going to get hurt if we are friends.
But you realize that when you were in their car at a third location the night and you can't just, especially in the pre-Uber era.
Yeah.
Like, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go?
Yes. Like, exactly. getting left at an apartment on the west side of Chicago after your friend just, like, leaves and is gone for, like, 3 hours and it's 5 a.m. and there are no cabs there. It's like, and then after that, you're like, okay, I'm done.
I think this is also, it's a very this movie thing, because I feel like when this happens now, you inevitably at some point learn that this person who seems nice in person has a totally unhinged social media personality.
Yes.
And there's this whole other life that they lead online.
So interesting.
That is like when you start to realize like who they actually are and it comes out of nowhere or like their online life suddenly collides or like you go and meet up with a bunch of people that they know from some like weird subreddit or something.
It's Gemini Aries rising energy for sure.
I don't know what that means, but it sounds true.
That's actually such an interesting point, because when I knew people like this, I was just remembering I was friends with this girl in high school who one day decided she was going to pierce her own tongue when I was like hanging out at her house.
Oh my god,
I guess we all were like, that's fine. Like, I was like, I wouldn't do that, but sure, I guess go ahead. And now I'm like, why did I sit there as she pierced her own tongue? That's insane. But I was just thinking, like, I had AIM, like, we didn't have.
Right.
Like, my context for people was just so different than it would be now. And it is really interesting to think about, like, because like, the ability to, like, put this on someone's profile and everybody in your family would know, it just didn't exist then.
That's a great point.
There was really no way to, like, embarrass someone in the same way.
There was just enough internet that you could meet people like this, but not so much internet that you would have all the information about them right away. You would see just a little bit of their online persona and be like, this person seems cool, seems nice. And then it turns out that they're Stephanie. I also really related to Derek trying to distract himself from his problems by doom scrolling dumb social videos on his phone, which is so sad. It just gets more and more desperate, more and more looking at vines. Definitely every time we got new poll numbers about Biden before he dropped out, that was me being Derek. Also, when they go to that hotel bar, the steel drum band with that woman dancing, I have been in that hotel bar so many times.
It was Lynchian. I would say that was very, it was like David Lynchian meets like what's that Thomas Pynchon novel that takes place in Florida? You know what I'm talking
Mason
about?
Mason Dixon?
Maybe. Okay. But there's like a dark, surreal quality to
underbelly.
It.
Underbelly. Yeah. Yeah, Jenixa Brown, I have not seen her other movie, Lemon, but it's supposed to be much more like Charlie Kaufman, David Lynch, like very surreal. I really want to watch it because she does capture that vibe so well.
There is another thing of like certain types of white women where you're like, why am I like, how did I get here? Like, this is too, like, we're not like, oh, we're not operating under the same rules. And I had that feeling so many times when she's like, when she's just sort of like, you're like, okay, I have to keep my eye on you because you might be the death of me if I'm not watching you very closely. And
right.
I, at the moment where she's like, from this point on, watch everything this bitch does is just such an incredible line in the movie because you realize what you're getting into.
Right. I think it's a great call. And it's one of many places where the movie does a great job of calling your attention to something without saying it explicitly. Like, she doesn't turn to the camera and say, like, this is the dynamic, but you definitely pick up on what's happening.
So I've heard other friends of mine who are not white have mentioned the crazy white girl that you got to watch out for. Can you talk a little bit more? I'm serious. I don't think I've ever been the crazy white girl that you got to watch out for.
I don't think you have either.
I'm
no,
super boring
that's not
now.
The energy.
But like, what is this, like, something that is kind of common among, like, a lot of women who are not white, that they're just like, watch out for this?
I wonder if this is also like a Georgia thing, like a Georgia, you know, like the area.
Yeah.
But like, I just remember that there were like some, especially because I grew up in a place where like you're supposed to be worried and scared of the black kids. It was like, oh no, there were like a couple of white girls who went to my high school whose like parents were kind of MIA and they kind of got to do whatever they want and they had money at their disposal and they always made very bad choices. They were perfectly nice girls, but you were like, if I hang out with you, like a main memory I have is being in the car with one of them and we started going backwards on the highway.
Oh
my God.
No.
It was like the middle of the night, like we were okay. But I was like, I remember being like, if this is how I die, my parents are going to be so mad at me. Like they put so much into me just to like go out like this. Like, there was sort of this, I mean, I think what thing a movie does very well is sort of this like carelessness about life that defines that period of your existence when you just aren't that careful. Like you don't really realize the risks of everything. But there's something very specific about this woman where you're like, oh, the thing that where she like says I have nice tits at the restaurant seems kind of fun and quirky. But now that my life is in her hands, I realize I don't trust her judgment at all. And I'm not, I don't want to be here with this person.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a lot that the movie does very subtly about the intersection of class and race. And like the real life Zola has talked about how Stephanie was like, she was from a more rural area of Michigan and she was poorer than her. And like Zola grew up a little bit more middle class. And like, I feel like that really comes through in the movie as well. And we learned very little about Z's background in the movie. And it's hard to find much out about him online. But Coleman Domingo, in talking about the choices that he made in the role, said that he really wanted to try to imbue him with a sense of coming from nothing and having kind of an immigrant story where that was part of what made him who he is.
Him going in and out of the Nigerian accent is
great.
So scary.
It's so scary. And it gives you this feeling that is also part of knowing people who are very online, where it's like this person has multiple identities. They're multiple personas. You don't know which one is real. You don't know when the other one is going to come out and you don't know how they intersect. I thought it was great.
Yeah. I think that the recklessness that people who have never really had to face consequences operate under is a very scary thing to be caught up in.
Yeah. The point of the movie is that 19-year-olds are terrifying and you should never get in a car with one. Absolutely never do it.
But it is a good point about the class thing, too, because it's not like Stephanie is, like, very privileged. Like, you're not like, oh, all this is entitlement.
Right.
There's just a very interesting kind of, like, interwoven thing going on there where you're like, you stress me out, but not in a way that, not in, like, a, oh, I'm driving my mom's BMW way.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's not falling neatly.
And the power dynamic that she plays is so interesting because it keeps, you know, sometimes she's entrapping Zola and she is like a participant with the Coleman Domingo character. And sometimes you see that she is like maybe the most victimized and the most powerless out of all of them.
Yeah. But Zola falls for her crying. Like that's how Zola, that's the entry into Zola until it like kicking up a notch is when Stephanie cries. Zola's like, I don't want to be involved in trapping. That's not why I came here. I'm leaving you in this hotel. And Stephanie cries. And Zola is like, oh.
But do you think that's not genuine?
I don't think it's genuine.
Really?
I think that she's gotten her way from crying before.
Okay, it's strategic.
And she might have been scared, but I think that she didn't necessarily. I think that the film leaves it a little bit ambiguous. But
I agree with that.
I think that she's definitely, I believe that she's scared, but I also don't believe that she needs Zola, because we see what happens when Z feels like he's been crossed by one of the clients.
Right.
So, like, you know, like, she's already been being protected by someone very scary.
Right.
It's also funny because the point at which she's like, you brought another friend into this, and Zola's like, wait, this isn't the first time.
Yeah.
Like, you do get the impression she's run this. She's done, she wants a little friend to do this. Like, she wants someone around. And maybe this time it's, like, a little bit crazier than it usually gets, but it's not her first time lying and saying, we're just going to go dance.
She's an escalating sex trafficker. She's escalating to the eventual arrest in Reno with, like, it's like, it's like if somebody who gets arrested for peeping through your window turns out to be a serial killer, you're like, woo, well, you knew that's where it was heading. But, you know, glad they caught you at this point rather than, anyway.
Okay, biggest real-world impact. Do we think this movie did anything for people's, like, nuanced understanding of the complexities of sex trafficking, the reality of it? I don't, like, the hard thing is this movie, I think, was a real casualty of the pandemic. So I feel like it did not have the impact that it deserved to have.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you guys think?
I think that once something really authentic has broken through the noise, the way that this Twitter thread and later the movie did, it's sort of, that's it. It, you know, you get one shot to make an impression the way that this made the impression. And and what the way that it changed things is that people understood that Twitter could be a path to a sort of virality that would make them a lot of money in a way that hadn't really been a thing before. There had been people who, I got hired for like a TV writing job because of Twitter. But like, you know, there weren't people like inking multi-million dollar deals and stuff like that. So I think that this kind of, I don't want to say ruined it because I think that this thread was incredible. But like once something, lightning can't strike twice
of
when
course.
It comes to that.
Once something is really successful, people are going to ruin it.
And by imitating it in really cynical ways.
Speaking of imitating it, what do we think if they were going to make this now, what do you think is the version of this that they would make now? Like what's the viral Twitter thread that they would make into a movie? Personally, I'm ready for the Krasensteins Hulu series. 10 parts, maybe 20, two seasons, each of the brothers. We talked about the cat turd movie.
Yeah, it it's feels hard like to it would have to be something. It would have to be dark. Like it would have to be surreal and a little dark because, but you know, I'm thinking even of like the kind of like pandemic, like QAnon, the like QAnon pandemic people who went from being pretty to all of a sudden being like, I don't want my kid to get the polio vaccine. Like there are so many just like corners of Twitter where, but there really isn't as much space to just like tell a funny story without, you know, everybody willfully misunderstanding it or making it into something it's not.
That's true. Yeah, the Zola Twitter thread would be played very differently now because
people would
be doing like counter threads about how mad they were about it or picking nits with it or objecting to parts of it. That's a great point.
Fact checking it now. And then Fox News would decide what lane it's in and then just hammer whatever character they decided they wanted to morally. I think that it would have something, it would be very dark, and I think, Josie, you're on the right track, but I think it would be like the Instagram, like crunchy to alt-right pipeline.
Oh,
it would be about somebody's descent into like complete madness. There was this yogi in Santa Monica named Guru Jagat who went seriously during pandemic, just like lost her fucking mind and ended up, she passed a few years ago. Long after the pandemic. There is a podcast series about it. I think it's from the LA Public Radio Station. They have a podcast series on it. I highly recommend anybody listen to it because it's such a good documentation of like another like spiral.
Right.
Like somebody starts off like kind of on the fringes, but still like, doing their thing, not hurting anybody. And then like at the very end, it is not a happy place.
You're making me glad that they're not making a movie out of that because it's just, it's too real right now and it would just be too sad. And this does feel like the rare case of a Twitter thread that is about something that is very serious and does have things that are really dark and sad about it, but is also just a fun ride.
Right. Well, how about like an RFK Jr. documentary or like a TV series, a limited series about all of his very weird adventures.
Who's going to play the brain worm?
Adventures.
I think David Schwimmer. David Schwimmer is the brain worm.
David Schwimmer is 100% the brain worm.
Absolutely. Okay, Let's finish things off with our traditional round of true or false. I'm going to read out a series of rapid-fire quotes or plot points of the movie, and you tell me whether it is true or false in the sense that you agree or disagree with the sentiment expressed. True or false, this is from David Cushing, the guy who wrote the Rolling Stone story that the movie is partly adapted from. It is, quote, Spring Breakers meets Pulp Fiction as told by Nicki Minaj. I don't know, you guys don't like that,
false.
Huh? Wow.
I liked it up until Nicki Minaj, I think.
The Nicki Minaj part rubbed me the wrong way as well.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
It's
yes.
Like, do you know enough black
right,
women
yeah,
to
that's,
name?
It's big, you look like Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah, exactly. I think Asia's voice or Zola's voice is so singular and unique that that's kind of insulting to her.
Yeah. Okay, I agree with that. Okay, we're gonna call it I would like to call it partly true for the Spring Breakers meets Pulp Fiction, but we can rank it false for the Nicki Minaj. True or false, a line from Stephanie, follow for follow. I say true.
Yeah.
You got to follow back.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah, I agree.
Unless you're annoying and then I block.
Okay.
Immediately block.
Or you do the force unfollow where you block and then unblock them.
No, I just block them.
Okay.
Straight up
block
them.
Okay, good for you. True or false, I don't know if you guys caught this line. It's the first scene at Hooters. The guy who's he's with, Jonathan, says this. I only caught it this time around because I had subtitles on. He said, quote, the hormones in the food help out the hormones in the water.
True. Absolutely true.
I had some real science. Joe Rogan shit. Somebody has said that on a Joe Rogan episode at some point.
Oh, Elon Musk
incredible.
Is
incredible.
That's right. Yeah, it's an Elon Musk
tweet.
Yeah,
that, no.
Yeah. I really want to know where the where Jeremy O'Hara got that line.
And that's why
so
we
funny.
Got to abolish the EPA.
That's right. That's right. Because
exactly.
The hormones they help each other.
They're
out.
They're helping each other.
Helping each other out. True or false? If a guy follows you to a liquor store in the dead of night and offers to show you around Tampa to help you navigate your relationship woes, say yes. go
yes.
For it. Yeah.
Yes. YOLO.
There's such a like Jenga of bad decisions.
I know it really.
And so many pieces of it's like, know what? Fuck it.
But at that point, you've already made so many bad decisions.
There.
You just keep
just
doing
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spring
just keep
break.
Going.
Spring
what could
break.
Go wrong?
True or false? If you get called out on social media, go with the copyrighted Stephanie response, which is to confirm everything but claim that your accuser is actually the one who did everything that you accused of while you watched on appalled and not understanding what was happening. Is that how that works? Because I don't know how that works.
True. What else do you have at that point? Go for
it. I want to see more people use the Stephanie defense. It's incredible.
I'm going to go ahead and say I'm going to use the Trump official in court defense, which is I don't recall. Like, I don't even know who this person is. I've never even seen her in my whole life.
That's a smarter response.
I don't
than
remember that.
Sure.
I don't recall.
Okay. That's a good answer. She made $1. True or false, Zola, and she said this on this Julia Fox podcast, invented threads. What do we think? I'm going to give her at least partial credit. I don't think she was the first one to do it, but I think that she is one of the people who blasted it into the stratosphere and made it a thing. Because this was right when, like, just before this, you couldn't even have tweets in a series. You had to have, like, each individual tweet you had to read separately.
Okay.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm. She was to threads what the U.S. dream team in the 90s was to Olympic basketball. It just elevated it to something
right.
that was more important and bigger than it had ever been.
It made everybody aware of it, even if she was not literally the first to do it. True or false, Zola is the first movie to use urine color as a point of character development. It's the first I'd seen.
I think, yes, true. That scene is a little, it's rough. And
it's intense.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, she's really dehydrated.
I know. My girl is not healthy.
No.
All right, this is last one. True or false, and this is a quote that the real-life Derek, Cousin Greg's character, gave to the Daily Mail right after this experience. Quote, really the lesson I've learned from all this is that anything on social media can blow up. I'm going to say true.
True.
I'm going to say Derek nailed it.
True.
Derek's life can blow up on social media for sure.
He's doing fine now, which I was glad to see. It sounds like he and Zola are friends, but boy, he should really not get into any more cars unaccompanied by an
Ever.
Adult.
Ever.
Well, Aaron Josey, this was great. I had so much fun chatting Zola with you all. Thank you so much for coming on.
No, thanks for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Offline Movie Club is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Max Fisher. It's produced by Emma Illich Frank. Mixed and edited by Charlotte Landis, with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Vasilis Fotopoulos. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Ari Schwartz, Madeline Herringer, and Adrian Hill for production support.